Welcome to Oak City Church, a family of learners, lovers, and givers sent. For more information, visit us online at oakcitychurch.com. Let us know if we can help you in any way. Thank you for listening.
With the series that we're doing for Advent, we've called Why We All Need a Big Dose of Christmas. And so we're going to go through over the next few weeks, hope and peace and joy and love, and this week is we're going to talk about hope. Now, we started it off with kind of a quiet thing, and candles are quiet, and they're peaceful, and you can stare at a candle, and it's a peaceful thing, but I don't find waiting to be a peaceful thing. It's my first big theological statement for the day, is that I think waiting stinks. All right, is anybody with me on that, that waiting is stinks? Yeah, waiting is a difficult thing to do, and waiting involves tension, because waiting involves hoping for something that you don't have, and you're hoping that you'll get it, but you're not sure that you'll get it, and so there's just an anxiety that's involved in that, and this is a life of faith and hope, so there's always waiting. I mean, if you're following the Lord, you're waiting in some way, shape, or form. I was reminded of that this week because I traveled. I don't travel a whole lot. I went to Dallas and with this group of pastors that I meet with a couple times a year. We met with a woman named Jen Wilkin. Does anybody know who Jen Wilkin is? If you know who she is and you want to find out, this is five of us pastors and Jen and a coworker, and we spent 4 hours together, and it was fascinating. So if you want to hear more about that, you can let me know. But traveling was not fascinating. So my flight was at 6:30. I flew United. This ends up being relevant, apparently, according to people in between services. And so I checked in the night before on their app. I downloaded the app, and I checked in. I was on the ball, and I got there an hour early because I thought an hour early would be enough. I did not know that they now have a fare. You know, it used to be you could just take your bag, and you could either check it, or you could take it on the plane, and you had to pay for it because you've already paid several hundred dollars for a plane ticket, okay? I'm a little bent out of shape about the whole thing. And so now, then, if you want to check your bag, you have to pay for it. But I want to check my bag anyway because I think they're going to lose my bag. So I try and take the bag on the plane. And now it's like if you don't get the bag on the plane, they got to take it at the door anyway. So, I tricked you and you took my bag and I didn't have to pay for it. But now they caught up to us. And there's the fare. I didn't know that there was this fare or that I got it as a basic economy fare. And you can't even try to take your bag on the plane. You have to pay them to check the thing. And so that was a little disappointing. But I did it the night before. So I thought I'm just going to show up at the airport at 5:30. And just drop my bag off. All I have to do is drop the bag off, right? Well, there's like several hundred other people that have to drop the bag off, and we're all waiting in this big line at 5:30 in the morning. And even though I've given myself an hour, I'm not feeling real good about things. You know what I mean? Like thinking this might not go well, and it's going to go well, but it might not go well, so there's tension, and that line isn't moving very fast. And so eventually a guy comes around and says, hey, who's going to Houston? And that's where my connection was. So a bunch of us get in the Houston line, so that Houston line can go faster than the regular line because we're late, which puts more tension in the situation. Then the line that I was in is going faster than the Houston line, so the people that I was next to are getting into the security line while I'm in the Houston line, so I go find the guy that put us in the Houston line and say, hey, bud, the Houston line ain't working out so well. And so he comes over, and so he gets the line moving, and so that's good. And then we did get a break in the security thing because they didn't ask us to take the computer out of the bag or take any clothes off, which is a bonus, but it makes you a little bit nervous at the same time because you assume that they do all that stuff for a reason, but maybe they don't. And so then I get to the gate, and sure enough, I got to the gate like 20 minutes before the plane is supposed to take off, but they're like, final boarding call. And they say it in such a way like, you idiots, where have you been? Final boarding call, we're waiting for you, you know? And they give you a dirty look, and it's like you're the last one on the airplane. And then you get on that thing, the terminal and the plane, and it's like playing charades. And what's this thing?
Gangway.
They said it was the jet bridge in the first gangway. Whatever it is, you get on that thing, and you realize there's people like two-thirds of the way through it. So like, hurry up, you're late, but just sit there, you know? Instead, I'm in the back of the plane, like the last person, and then we take off a half an hour after we're supposed to anyway. I'm just like, you've got to be kidding me. We should never lose sight of the fact that we're getting into a magic tin can and we're halfway across the country in the morning. Like, that's still a pretty amazing thing, but I'm really glad that I don't have to do that too often because it just doesn't, I know it's not a fun process, but there's tension in it. Like, if there's a wait, I might not should be, but I'm just tense. Because you're not sure it's going to go the way that it's supposed to go. And it's like a microcosm of what our wait and our tension is like. Because there's a desired outcome that you think is going to happen. You know, the plane is going to get wherever it's supposed to go. You put your hope in something. You know what I mean? Like spiritually, we put our hope in the Lord. In this case, I'm not so much putting my hope in the airline as I am in the market of people that have to use the airline all the time that are constantly badgering the airline about getting their job done. And so I'm putting my faith in something that the deal is going to happen the way that it's supposed to. When we wait, we tend to want to just take control of the situation. And so when I get out of the line and I find the Houston guy and say the Houston line isn't moving, I feel a little bit better about myself because I've helped the situation. I have an illusion of control that has distracted me for a minute about the wait. And we do that all the time, right? Like we do the same thing where we try and grasp some little bit of control over the situation, and that's just how waiting is, and there's tension in the in-between spot of where we are and where we think we're supposed to be in Christmas, and Advent really is a chance to step back and just engage that. I think that's what the season of Advent is a chance to step back and engage that and just to see how you're doing with it. Like, what are you waiting for? And just to like try and name those things. What is it that I'm waiting for? What am I hoping in for that reality to come true? Am I hoping that the Lord is going to, he's doing his thing, or am I taking control of the situation? So how well are we waiting? And inevitably, if you're following Jesus, you're waiting. I mean, ultimately, that's what we're doing. Paul says that we groan, our bodies groan as we await the redemption of our bodies. And so there is a waiting for things to be the way that they're supposed to be. We're waiting for the kingdom in a big way, you know, for things to be the way that we know that they're supposed to be, and Jesus has promised that they will be. But in little ways, we're waiting for the kingdom to come in our hearts and in our relationships and in our lives and in our families. And so we go through that thing of who are we putting our hope in and how sure is our hope? Like on a scale of 1 to 10, how confident am I right now that God is going to come through with the thing? Because it's always like wavering a little bit, you know, it's always varying. And where does the tension drive me? This week in our Bible reading plan, one of the verses was about drawing near to the Lord and he'll draw near to you. And so tension has the tendency to either draw you near to the Lord, that tension is going to take you to the Lord because you're depending on him, or it's going to take you to a place where you take control of the situation and probably make a bigger mess of it than it was before you decided to take control of the situation. And you get in a spot where you feel like you're being taken advantage of, you know, because you have to wait and you feel slightly disrespected. Like if we're all honest, we feel like we should just be able to drive up to the airplane on the runway, get out, get in the plane, and have them valet park our car. Like, that's what should happen for the money that we're paying. But we do that with the Lord, and Paul says, I've become a fool for Christ's sake. And that's just how it feels sometimes. And so Advent engages all of those emotions and asks us to sit in them and just see how well we're doing and maybe refocus on them. And I don't know what you're waiting for. You could be waiting for little things. You could be waiting for big things. You could be single and waiting like on a spouse and just wrestling with God about that. You could be waiting on a child, and that could be like you want a child and you don't have children, or it could be you're waiting for a child to like come around, you know, and these people that are closest to you, or a parent or a brother or sister, these people that are closest to you, like you've been praying for something for them for so long and you're waiting to see what's going to happen. You could be waiting on the future. You could be a teenager or a college student thinking, man, I want my life to get going. And so it just feels like I'm on a holding pattern now, and so I'm waiting on what God has for me in my future. You could be waiting to see how just smaller things are going to turn out, some financial situation, a family situation, a work situation, a ministry project that God has called you into, and seeing how things are going to work. It could be a relationship with someone that doesn't know Jesus and you want them to, and so you've been praying for them and looking for opportunities to talk to them about who Jesus is, and you just don't, you're not sure that anything is happening there, you know, and so you're waiting. And so we're all in that space where we're waiting, and the messages I have geared towards that, and this one in particular, just trying to help us. They said this last week, Scripture is like a mirror sometimes, and so you see yourself, and it gives you a clearer picture and helps you to see what to do in the situation that you're in. And I feel like this passage is one of those passages. So this is a story from Luke, and it's a couple characters in the Christmas story named Zechariah and Elizabeth, and it picks up these themes about hope and waiting in big ways. So in the days of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah of the division of Abijah. He had a wife from the daughters of Aaron. Her name was Elizabeth, and they were both righteous before God, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and statutes of the Lord. That's important, walking blamelessly in the statutes and commandments of the Lord. But they had no child because Elizabeth was barren, and they were both advanced in years. So that's kind of a scene. Luke has put some things in this that can be a little bit hard to see. Some of them were kind of obvious, but where he picks up on the big storyline of the Bible and that there's just a wait going on, and their wait is a wait within the wait. So Israel has been waiting on the promises of the Lord for 2,000 years. You know, God had come to Abraham and said, I'm going to make you a great nation, and all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed through you. And so they've kind of seen some of that happen, but they know they haven't seen it happen the way that it's supposed to happen. And in the recent history of this, they've been waiting a lot. And so when he writes it this way, like he's engaging that wait. And when he talks about Zechariah and Elizabeth and these righteous people that have been called by the Lord, and she's older, but she's without child, even some of the specific wording to an Israelite who's familiar with the Old Testament story, this passage right here is going to scream Abraham and Sarah. Like, it's just going to pick up on that storyline, and they're going to realize that he's talking about a wait, but he's talking about the wait within the wait. There's another passage in just a minute. An angel is going to come to Zechariah. I'm not going to go through that whole thing, but the angel is going to quote the very last words of the Old Testament. So the last book in our Old Testament is Malachi. The last words of Malachi are this: Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet. Before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes, he will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and of the children to their fathers. Last words of the Old Testament. It's been 400 years since those have been written down. They've been waiting 400 years for God to say another thing. Then this angel shows up to Zechariah and says this, that your son will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. He will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah and turn the hearts of the fathers to the children. He uses the exact same language. And in Israel, at reading, it's like, whoa, it's go time. Like, here we go. Our wait is over. And 400 years, you just kind of got to get into that. That's a long time to wait. You know, 400 years ago was 1618. I asked this first service, like, what was going on in 1618? And so someone came up to me between services and said, Sir Walter Raleigh was beheaded in 1618. So this is good. Like, you got your own research department of a church to figure that stuff out. So that's what was going on. And something about Kepler's third law of something. I don't even know who that was, you know? But that's what was going on 400 years ago. That's a long time to wait, and they've been waiting that long. Now, impressive, they're waiting that long, 400 years, and they're still doing their thing that God called them to do in the midst of that wait. So it says, while he was serving as a priest before God, when his division was on duty, according to the custom of the priesthood, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and burn incense, and the whole multitude of the people were praying outside at the hour of incense. So, you need to catch this, like, in the Old Testament, they got all these rules about when the priests go in and which divisions the priests are in and what duties they have. And so they cast lots, and that's how God would choose them in order to do their duty that they have. And so he goes in, he burns incense, and not only is he doing his thing, but a whole multitude of people is praying outside at the hour of incense. Like, all the people are engaged in this. Like, after 400 years, that's pretty impressive. God has made a promise, he's told them to do their thing, and they keep doing their thing. And so I say this just to say it's possible to wait well and to wait very well. Like, you can do it. It's possible to wait very well. This thing for him was probably just a huge honor. He probably only got to do this a couple times in his life. And when he goes to do the incense, like the way the temple was laid out, you know, and this is a big temple. This is Herod's temple. And so it's really big and fancy, really nice. And there's the outer courts of the temple, and then the inner courts of the temple. And the inside of the temple, there's the holy place, and then there is right behind it the most holy place. So you probably could have named that better, but the holy place and the most holy place. And there's a curtain that separates them. And in the holy place, there's the altar of incense, and there's like this candelabra thing, and then there's the bread of the presence. And these all represent different things in the Old Testament, and about the pictures of heaven, really. And then behind the curtain is the Ark of the Covenant. And I just want to make an Indiana Jones reference then. But so that's where that is. And the curtain is the thing that when Jesus dies, like, tears from the top to the bottom because God ripped it so we can go in the presence of God. Because only the high priest went into that most holy place once a year. according to how God prescribes it, but they go into this thing on a routine basis and do the thing. So he's got the incense, but he's like a couple feet away from the Ark of the Covenant and the very presence of God. You know what I mean? Like, it's a big deal for him to be in this space. And it says that when he's in there, there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense, and Zechariah was troubled when he saw him, and fear fell upon him. So he's doing his incense thing, and just, it's been 400 years people have been doing this. He's doing his incense thing, and then just boom, out of the corner of his eye, he's like, there is something there that was not there just a minute ago, and is not supposed to be there. And angels scare people every time they show up in the Bible, just about. They scare people. That miracles book that I referenced, he has this thing about seeing angels, and they're like 30 feet tall. So I picture this giant, dazzling angel. And he is like scared to death. And what do I do here? There's no rules for what you do with the incense when an angel shows up. Do I still do the incense? Do I just ignore him and pretend that he's not there? Do I talk to him? Or what do you do with an angel? And it says that he's troubled and fear fell upon him, and we would be troubled too. And the angel says to him, don't be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear a son, and you shall call his name John. So we get deeper into the story. Like, they haven't had a kid. They've been praying for a kid. And now he says, your prayer is going to be answered. This is an interesting, it's just, you got to get into this, but it's an interesting thing. They've been waiting for a long time. Zechariah and Elizabeth have been waiting for a long time. Israel has been waiting for a long time. When you wait for something for a long time, you can kind of get into a routine that can be a rut. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. Like, they were waiting well. But then it can be hard to jump the rut and get into a different rut when they say, okay, your wait is almost over. You know what I mean? Like, it can be like a too good to be true thing if God gives you some signal that says your wait is almost over. And the wait for them was not an easy wait, and waiting is rarely easy. So just another like dynamic in this story, and I'm not gonna go to this verse, but in just a few verses in this story, Elizabeth is gonna respond to the message from the angel that she's gonna have a baby, hopefully, and she's gonna say, "Now the Lord will take my reproach away." And so, like, that is the clue that this wait has been really difficult. So they're advanced in years, so they're an older couple. And they don't have a kid. Now, in our culture, I don't know that there's a stigma about not having children in our culture. Maybe there is, but it's just not as pervasive as maybe it used to be. In the church, I know that, like, we don't do great with that. There can be a stigma about being single or not having children in the church, and that's a problem. It's still nothing like it was back then. Like, in their day, if you didn't have a kid, you didn't have a kid because God was angry with you because you did something wrong, and you not having a kid was like a form of punishment. And so when she says, he will take my reproach away, that is just a loaded statement of, for years, she has been dealing with what people have been putting on her or worrying about what people think about her because they don't have any kids. And the language that I noted in the very first verse was that they were completely blameless before the Lord. Right? They did nothing wrong, but God engaged them in a wait for his own purposes. That's just a huge point. I read a quote from a pastor, it's John Piper, a few years ago, where he said, God is always doing like 10,000 things in your life at any one moment. You are aware of about three of them, and that's it. You know? And God is using their wait, Zechariah and Elizabeth, as a part of the bigger wait. Like, they just could not know that they're waiting for, I don't know how long. Like, I'm guessing 10, 15, 20, maybe 25 years. Just waiting and still waiting and faithfully praying. And every bit of me would be tempted to say the ship has sailed. Like, it would be so much easier just not to deal with it anymore. But they do that, not having any idea that their wait is going to play this huge part with John the Baptist in the bigger wait that Israel has been going through. You're waiting, like I said a minute ago, it will probably tempt you to draw near to the Lord, or it'll tempt you to like just take control of your own situation. And this couple draws near to the Lord, but there's nothing easy about it. Now, here's what he says next. It says, Zechariah said to the angel, how shall I know this? For I'm an old man and my wife is advanced in years. You just got to read that slowly. And Zechariah said to the angel, how shall I know this? If I'm the angel, I'm thinking, I don't know, maybe God could send an angel. And then you'd know. You know, like Zechariah said to the angel, how shall I know this? But we all do it. And so this is my third point in this. We usually don't wait as well as we wished we had. I did think, to give Zechariah the benefit of the doubt, I could totally see him being in the situation where he sees the angel, and the angel says, you're going to have a kid. And he thinks about his wife and what she's been through for so many years, and could say that in a way of like, don't you dare tease me with this or her and give her hope that she's going to have this kid without it happening. I could see him wanting to guard her heart. At the same time, he's got this angel and he's like in the altar of incense and there's this huge angel. So I don't think I should probably give him that much doubt. He's just like us. And so even though we have good reason to believe, we have a hard time believing, like with it staring us in the face. The angel says to him, I'm Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God. I was sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. And then he says, behold, you'll be silent and unable to speak until the day that these things take place because you didn't believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time. So he says, you want a sign that this is legit? Well, you can't talk until the baby's born. There you go. Have a sign. I don't know if that's how that went, but that's how I envision it. And we do the same thing in big ways and in little ways. I said this last week, in the work series we talked about, just as a side thing, like how many of you have felt like God has impressed something upon you or audibly said something to you or had some type of vision where God spoke, and two-thirds of you raised your hands. And I said, how many of you doubted it, and two-thirds of you raised your hands? Like, that's just what we do. We approach Christmas as the season where we're waiting, and we're just waiting to see if the Lord is going to come through on some things, which ultimately is asking, like, is God powerful enough, and is God good enough, and is God with us and for us? And Christmas is about like celebrating this event where God put on flesh to show us exactly what he's like and to show us exactly how he feels about us, that he loves us and he's good and he's generous and he's kind and he's humble and all these things. And yet in our waiting, we're pretty constantly asking, what is God like, and is he with me? Does he love me? And so he might be thinking, well, Christmas, I kind of did that to show you all this stuff, and it wasn't enough. And that's how it can be. It's not enough. It's never enough. And it always calls us to draw near. So we usually don't wait as well as we wish we had waited. So we wait well. It's possible to wait well. Waiting's difficult. We don't wait as well as we wish we could. And then there's just another thing that comes out of this story, that God uses our waiting to do his work. And so if he's doing 10,000 things in your life at any one time, he's doing 10 like gajillion things around you, the lives around you, when he's doing this. And so I noted something towards the end of this story. It's a long story, but so they have the baby, and it says that the time came for Elizabeth to give birth, and she bore a son. And her neighbors and relatives heard that the Lord had shown great mercy to her, and they rejoiced with her. And I just don't want to skip by that. The neighbors heard that God had shown great mercy to her, and they rejoiced with her. The neighbors were like in it with her. They knew about her reproach. They knew how hard this had been for her. And so when God did this work in their life, the neighbors were in it. And God got glory in the hearts and souls of the neighbors because they'd lived this in such a way that the people around them could see it. Same with Zechariah. When immediately after the baby was born, his mouth was opened, his tongue was loosed, he spoke, blessing God, and fear came on all their neighbors, and all these things were talked about through the hill country of Judea, and all who heard them laid them up in their hearts, saying, what then will this child be? For the hand of the Lord was with them. And so again, when they see him not be able to speak, and then he can speak, and it says, fear came on all of the neighbors. And these things were talked about through all the hill country of Judea, and all who heard them laid them up in their hearts. God used their weight, and he was using it in them, but then he used it in the lives of all the people that he had close to them. And so what we want as a church is to reach our neighbors, to help them know and follow Jesus. we think following Jesus is what we were made to do, that he died on a cross for our sins, that he rose from the dead to show us that he has the power over death and that we will live forever with him because of what he's done for us. If you are here and you're not following Jesus, that's what we want for you because that's what we think you were made for. God is going to use your story to show what he's like to the people around you. And so in this situation, like it, waiting and this tension is something that I often don't want to let anybody into because I do feel like I'm getting taken advantage of or I'm not sure if God's there, so I don't want to let the people around me in on this stuff. But it's this type of stuff that God gets glory from because they enter into the tension and then they see how God resolves that tension, maybe in a way that we didn't expect, and then God gets glory from it. And so God is going to use your weight in the lives of the people around you. But you got to expect that that's going to happen and know that that's going to happen. I found something that a pastor put out this a few years ago about Advent that I thought fit with this. He said, lots of people know about holidays, one day a year set apart. The church calendar is about seasons, whole periods of time we enter into with a specific cry, a particular intention for a reason. Advent is about anticipating the birth of Christ. It's about longing, desire, that which is yet to come, that which isn't here yet. And so we wait expectantly together with an ache because all is not right. Something is missing. Why does Advent mean so much to me? It means so much to me because cynicism is the new religion of our world. Whatever it is, this religion of cynicism teaches that it isn't as good as it seems. It will let you down. It will betray you. That institution, that church, that politician, that authority figure, they'll all let you down. Whatever you do, don't get your hopes up. Whatever you think it is, whatever it appears to be, it'll burn you. Just give it time. Advent confronts this corrosion of the heart with the insistence that God has not abandoned the world. Hope is real, and something is coming. Advent charges into the temple of cynicism with a whip of hope, overturning the tables of despair, driving out the priests of that jaded cult, announcing there's a new day, and it is not like the one that came before it. The not yet will be worth it, Advent whispers in the dark. And so each December, we enter into a season of waiting, expecting, longing. Spirit meets us in the ache. We ask God to enter into the deepest places of cynicism, bitterness, and hardness, where we've stopped believing that tomorrow can be better than today. We open up. We soften up. We turn our hearts in the direction of that day when the baby cries his first cry and we, surrounded by shepherds and angels and everybody in between, celebrate that sound in time that brings our spirits what we've been longing for. That's my hope, is that this early in Advent gets you engaged in some things that you've been waiting on that maybe you've forgotten that you've been waiting on. Someone said to me in between services, they heard a pastor once say that waiting is an action. And that's true, and it doesn't feel like that, but it is. And that you'll do that action well and believe that it'll pay off and that will even surprise you in some way. That there's something in you that you maybe didn't even realize that you were hoping for, that you'd given up hope for, or that you still had hope for. I had another waiting experience recently. I mentioned this a month or two ago that I was going to run a marathon. And so I'd been training. There's waiting involved in this. So I've been training for 3 or 4 months. And that involves lots of long, boring runs. And so you end up on some 20-mile runs that take like 3-some hours. And when you run those, you realize the first 2 or 2.5 hours is just going to be boring because you're waiting to see if you're any better off than you were the last time you ran that long. And so it's just like a mental game to figure out if you can stay in the game. And I got to the race, and the race was the same way. Like I thought the first 15 miles, I just want to just stay in it. And at 15 miles, I'll figure out like kind of how I'm doing in this thing. And I gave myself like a C+ at 15 miles, which wasn't super optimistic. And then there was like a 3-mile hill from 15 to 18, and that was not good for me. And then I got to 20, and at 20, you just think you're going to go into a dark place for about an hour and see if you can make it out the other side. And what happened is I wasn't ready. My form broke down, and so my quads and my calves started cramping up, and so I had to stop and stretch and run and stop and stretch and run and stop and stretch for like the last 4 miles of the race, which just wasn't good. Like, that wasn't fun. So my dominant emotion when I got to the finish line was disappointment. Like, disappointment followed by anger, because I'd worked really hard and not gotten what I wanted. And then a little bit of shame because I didn't get there. And I don't even know that there was a tiny amount of joy in that. You know, you go through the finish line, they got a camera there, and people are like, ah, and I'm like, ah, this, yes. And so then, but then you go down a little bit further, and you turn the corner, and they start handing stuff out to you. So they give you a blanket, because it's cold out, and you don't got any clothes on. And then they give you this hat. Oh, I got this obnoxious hat that says finisher on it. And so I'll take it. Yeah. And then this lady is there, and she's handing out the medals. And I am telling you what, I saw her with the medal, and out of nowhere, I have no idea where this came from, I was fighting as hard as I could not to cry. Like, I was trying not to break down, because something came up to me of like, you did it, it's over. Like, it was a long deal, but you're there. You know what I mean? Later that day, someone was texting me about something else, and she didn't know anything about this, but she said, you know, a marathon is probably the only thing where you actually should get a participation trophy. For doing it. If you've been here for over the last few years, like, I'm just not big on participation trophies, and I, like, broke down when they gave me a participation trophy, so it has, like, shattered me. I think we're all at some level involved in something like that, where there's something that we've been running hard after, we've been waiting a long time on, and in some ways it's the big thing, right? Like, it's honest, it's heaven. It's that these little things where we think the kingdom is breaking in, which are exciting, after a while you're like, I just want the big one to break in, because I know he's able, and I know he can do it. And it's going to happen, right? But the little ones, like getting the victories in the little ones. And so I'm guessing that you're here, and either you can think of those things that you're waiting on and that you're engaged in the Lord with, and you're either waiting well, and I hope you take out of this, yeah, continue to wait well. It's hard. You'll screw it up every once in a while, but just keep waiting well and it will be worth it. Or you're here and you're not waiting well. And I want to challenge you to start waiting well on the Lord for whatever those things are that he's called you to, and that he's with you, and that it's going to be worth it. And I pray he uses this season to speak that into your heart. Father, thanks for your word, and thanks for this, you know, little story within the story of Christmas, of Zachariah and Elizabeth, and their wait over years and years, and who knows what it was like for Elizabeth, just in the dark at night, laying in bed thinking, God, what are you doing? In the same place that we get, Lord. And then after the fact, to have a child with her husband and to be a part of what God was doing, and it'd be John the Baptist and something so significant happened, and then to look back and think, God, you were there the whole time and you knew exactly what you were doing. And I should never have doubted you. And so, God, thank you that you put that in the Bible for us. I pray you'd meet us where we are, God, and speak to us in the midst of that, and either encourage us or challenge us as we need it, Lord, but that we would wait well for you, and that as a result of that, the people around us would see how good you are and be drawn to you. And we love you, and we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.